Good morning, everyone. It is Sunday, August 21st, 2011. We are continuing in Politics of Exclusion with a new section that we'll see is kind of, you know, I think it dovetails nicely from the previous classes that we've had, you know, not just from, you know, conservative Judaism, but also the series on Mark Shapiro and the Orthodox. And today we're talking about preserving gender roles. And one thing, you know, to summarize some of the Mark Shapiro piece, is that when we talk about Orthodox Judaism, I've never liked the term as a religious designation, but more of a social designation. And I think what Mark Shapiro really showed in his book is that for as much as Orthodox Judaism might tout being knowledgeable in Torah, being observant in Torah, that kind of is secondary to, you know, are you towing a certain party line, as we saw with Saul Lieberman, in that, you know, you have someone who is undoubtedly, as we saw, you know, from some of the citations, Tamid Chacham, observant in his own right, and yet, what was the thing that excluded him, right? It was the other stuff, it was the political stuff, which is part of why I define Orthodox Judaism as more of a social designation than a purely halachic one. By which I mean, again, if you want to talk about your tipping point of what's going to make you Orthodox or not Orthodox, it's not necessarily Torah, right? As we saw, you know, in the other case. Now, people might be upset with that, but unfortunately, you know, it happens, and I think we've seen in some other classes here there are certain sins that are more forgivable in Orthodoxy than others, even though they go against the Torah. I know I gave one example. You know, it seems weird, you know, if you point to, say, a conservative Jew who doesn't keep kosher and say, you know, that person is a frum, but you find someone who's affiliated Orthodox and cheats on his taxes and beats his wife and say, well, this person is a frum yid. That's, you know, another extreme example, but, you know, it helps illustrate the certain point that could be very uncomfortable, that it's really not about Torah or other stuff for Orthodox Jews, which is why I've also said personally, it's more important to be a Shomer Torah than an Orthodox Jew. And why, personally, I prefer the designation of Shomer Torah, Shomer Mitzvot, even though it might seem as ambiguous, but it does get more to the core of, you know, what I think Torah is. That's a separate rant for another time, which we might do in a separate series. But today, we're going to, you know, start a second, you know, it might be, I guess, oh, we'll see where this turns out to at the end. But I think the modern challenge that Orthodox Judaism is facing in terms of excluding someone for Orthodoxy is on the topic of what I call preserving gender roles. What I mean by this isn't, you know, does Orthodox Judaism need to exclude women? That's not the type of exclusion that we're talking about here. People are interested, you know, we can give a separate, you know, maybe after this we'll do a whole series on feminism. The point here isn't that women are excluded. The point is, by changing the traditional, putting that in quotes, role of women, or in terms of relationship between men and women, that somehow excludes you from traditional Orthodox Judaism. Meaning, what the thing is going to, you know, when we saw, you know, going back to what made you beyond the pale, right, you know, looking back in the Gemara, you know, time of Rambam, it was a lot in terms of, you know, either theological issues, or the mitzvot that you would have to do Shabbos was a big one. Right, if you're Mechalel Shabbat Bifar Hesia, you break Shabbat in public, then you're considered outside the camp. Excuse me. Today, you will be excluded from the Orthodox camp for doing, or, you know, for changing things that are, you know, certainly not as severe as, say, denying God. One example that we'll get to today is the case of Mechitza, separate seating in a synagogue. The sources here are mostly culled from this book, which, if anyone is interested on Mechitza in Judaism, I can't recommend this book enough. It's called The Sanctity of the Synagogue, The Case for Mechitza, Separation Between Men and Women in the Synagogue by Baruch Litvin. It came up out of a struggle. It says here, it was lonely struggle for the sanctity of the synagogue in Mount Clemens, Michigan. Sure, they wanted to take out a mechitza. He took on a crusade to make sure it was there, or at least to keep it up there. So this book isn't like a normal read-through book in that, you know, it's not, you know, doesn't really have, you know, clear arguments, but it or like it's not one person writing it. It's more of a compilation, I suppose, of a lot of other sources and a lot of other texts put in, including some of the court documents from his actual case.
But it's more polemic than a study.
Yes and no. I mean, it's a polemic in the sense that, you know, the author, Baruch Litvin, takes a certain position that there ought to be a mechitza and there ought to be separate seating in a sanctuary. He does do, certainly when he cites rabbinic sources about separation, does do some impressive cherry-picking in terms of which sources he, you know, how deep he has to find certain sources. But I would also add that a lot of the letters, but two people we're going to see today, are polemical in nature, in that they're advocating for a certain position. Polemical is even a little bit loaded there. We'll see, we can argue about whether or not some of them are polemical. But the point is in terms of a compendium, and you want to know, well, what are one side's arguments for it? Right, it's an excellent resource, if nothing else, as an anthology of collected sources. If there's any complaint I have, I wish like some of the letters would have been better dated in terms of like here's like the date it was written. Not all of them have like the precise citations. Minor quibble. If anyone is interested in Mechitza, it's a worthwhile read to at least see one side of the argument. If we have time, see another side today. But keep that as a bonus for the end.
Are there any Orthodox synagogues without Mechitza?
Great question. The answer today, I'm not sure if any exist today. We saw in Rav Moshe Feinstein that it appeared in his day, or at least in the 50s, that there was at least, he did mention that there was an Orthodox-affiliated synagogue without a Mechitza, and he said, better be in that synagogue than in the conservative one. Hmm. Or at least not even without a Mechitza, he said, without a kosher Mechitza. And we'll see that clarification a little bit later. There are some synagogues, maybe few, probably less than 10, in America that are affiliated Orthodox and that they're part of the Orthodox Union that do not have a Mechitza. I believe, and if anyone's listening correctly, if I'm wrong, there's one in Buffalo Grove in Illinois, by Chicago. And these days, I think you would only get permission from the RCA to take that pulpit if you intend to put in a Mechitza. So they're technically grandfathered in, but you know people really, really owe very much so.
Yeah. I thought there was one in Denver.
It's quite possible.
The rabbi left for Stanford because he felt that insisting on a mechitza would tear the community apart.
Possible. I have no idea. So today, there could be a few, but they're all grandfathered. Mm. No new Orthodox shul would not have a mechitza. And it's turned into, for lack of a better term, in this case, partially intentional, becomes one of the dividing lines between conservative and Orthodox, and you know probably was back then. So let's start going through a couple of sources here before we get to the secondary. Before we get to the modern sources. The two people I've included here, we have one letter from Rav Moshe Feinstein and also from Rav Soloveitchik. But it's important to first see Gemara and Sukkah, off of which much of the arguments are based. So we'll see the primary source inside before we get to the others. And take us, first off, this is a Gemara and Sukkah 51b to 52a.
Our rabbis have taught originally the women used to sit within the court of the women while the men were without. But as this caused levity, it was instituted that the women should sit without and the men within. As this, however, still led to levity, it was instituted that the women should sit above and the men below. But how could they do so? After the original structure of the temple.
Alter the original structure. I mean, the question is, this is how the Beit HaMikdash was supposed to be built. Initially, you had like one arrangement of men and women. That was problematic. We'll talk about that. You had another problematic. So Gemara then says, they built a balcony of some sort. So then, how could you do that? Right? Go ahead and explain. Is it not written?
Is it not written? All this do I give thee in writing, as the Lord hath made me wise by his hand upon me, Rav answered. They found a scriptural verse and expounded it. And the land shall mourn every family apart, the family of the house of David apart, and their wives apart. Zechariah.
Meaning he's quoting a pasuk here from Zechariah, where it says that, you know, the land will mourn, families will be apart, you know, the house of David and their wives apart. So then he asks,
what this has to do with the Brooklyn Bridge, I don't know, just...
Well, we'll finish it off. You have to finish the... You've got to finish the section before you ask the question.
Is it not, they ask, an a fortiori argument?
Yeah, kal vachomer.
If in the future, when they will be engaged in mourning and the evil inclination will have no power over them, so that levity is least to be expected. The Torah nevertheless says, men separately and women separately. How much more so now at the festivities of the water drawing, when they are engaged in rejoicing and the evil inclination has sway over them.
Right, so it says here, sit separately. This is the Sensino translation. But it's anashim levad v'nashim levad, that men and women are separated. What's going on here is as follows. During the Simchat Beit HaShoeva, celebration time of Sukkot, you initially had men and women that were in the same area, or at least in different areas, you know, but there was too much levity, kalut rosh, which you could give, you know, a whole class on what that means. So sages saw there was a problem, saw that the men and the women needed to be separated, to the point where, according to Rav's explanation, they even made a change to the structure of the temple because they saw there was a need for it. And that if in a time of mourning you can split families, so, you know, to split men and women, then certainly now, when, you know, the evil inclination is over them, right, you know, it's the kal vachomer to the extent where, you know, there needed to be some physical reconstruction of the temple. That is this Gemara, right? Take the Gemara, you know, at however you wish on face value, but we'll see now how that gets turned in, or how this gets used in terms of advocating or mandating a mechitza in a shul. One other thing about the source sheets here that's a little bit different. My printer died, and I picked up a new one that has a scanner. So I'm actually able now to scan stuff from the book and use OCR, the optical character recognition, to get out the text, which means typos here aren't my fault. They're the OCRs this time, and, you know, maybe something, you know, went through in the editing. But yeah, these are all now scans. So first off, we're going to deal with Rav Moshe Feinstein. Hopefully we'll, you know, if we can't do everything, you know, we may split this one up into 2 weeks. Again, well, that, no pun intended, and just let it slide. Anyway, so first we're going to do with Rav Moshe Feinstein. Again, all of the texts here in the translations are from the Sanctity of the Synagogue. So
there are localities in this, our country, where people are breaking with the practice of having a mechitza to separate men from women in the synagogue in a little sanctuary that yet remains to us, Mikdash Ma'adar.
Correct. Little sanctuary, it's going to come up a lot. One of the reasons why people will make the analogy to the Beit HaMikdash is that a synagogue, a Beit Knesset, is called the Mikdash Ma'at, a mini, you know, temple. So while it's not exact, like you don't have giant golden statues of angels or an altar, the fact that it is called by Chazal Mikdash Ma'at gives you a basis to make analogies between the temple and a synagogue.
How far back does that terminology go?
Mikdash Ma'at, I believe it's rabbinic, but I'd have to double check.
Undoubtedly, they do not intend willfully to transgress the law, but rather act from a lack of knowledge of the severity of the prohibition. It is therefore essential to explain the origins of the law, its stringency, and the minimum height of a mechitza, physical separation, partition, screen, etc., which the law might require. The basic rule is that even if men are on one side and women on the other, it is still forbidden for them to be without a mechitza, and this would seem to be a biblical injunction.
Yeah, that emphasis is in the original. So, key line here, according to Rav Moshe, that if men and even if men and women are separated, there's no mechitza, according to Rav Moshe, you're violating a biblical prohibition.
Is there a distinction between midoraisa and midinavim or something?
Well, midorabbanan, that's your only other option. You've got doraisa, midorabbanan, things that are, well...
Because it's not midoraisa.
Well, okay, first off, we're going to finish Rav Moshe's argument here. In terms of the different levels and how do you deal with a psukim from Navi, truth is, the Gemara is kind of inconsistent in that... You will find every now and again someone citing a verse from Nevi'im and calling it a law. One example is of Lo Yimad Lo Yisafer, one of the arguments that, not arguments, one of the supports for not counting Jews is based off of Psukim and Navi, and the term lav is actually used. Well, there's one opinion of Rebbe Lazar that says lav, and someone else says shnei lavim, that lo yimad is one and lo yisafer is another, because it uses a double language of not counting. You also have, though, divrei halacha mi divrei kabbalah lo yal, divrei torah mi divrei kabbalah lo yalpinan, which is that you can't actually extrapolate biblical laws from works of the prophets. You know, we can leave that for other scholars to try to debate. For conventional purposes, yeah, you normally would need to cite a book from the Pentateuch, five books of Moses, in order to call it a d'oraisa.
The proof lies in Sukkah 51a. There, the Talmud speaks of the balcony that was erected in the women's court of the temple. On the eve of the second day of the Sukkot festival, so that the women could be relegated to the upper level and the men to the lower, to watch from there the Simchat Beit HaShoeva, the festival of drawing water for libations.
Right.
And the question is raised, but it is written that David said to Solomon about the temple plans, "All this is in writing, as the Lord hath made me wise by his hand upon me, even all the works of this pattern," 1 Chronicles 28:19, indicating that it was forbidden to add anything to the scripture of the temple and the courts. Rav replied that they, the sages, came across a verse in scriptures, Zechariah 12:12, signifying that it was necessary to have a separation between men and women. See Rashi's amplification ad loc.
All right, so far he's just summarized the Gemara that we've seen. All right? Go ahead.
Quite obviously, the import of the reply is that with the verse they found, it is as if the projecting balcony had been explicitly ordained, and there was thus no need to have God the seer and Nathan the prophet transmit this matter when they save instruction about the working plans. Is there a question there?
I can check.
That's a ton of point.
All right. Well.
1 Chronicles 28:29. Oh, when they gave instruction, probably.
That's probably it.
Now had.
What?
You're up to now.
Yeah, had. Yeah. Now had the balcony been required only by a rabbinic prescription, it would be impossible to say that a rabbinic law could override the biblical dictum that all the temple plans were given in writing, and hence were not to be modified. And in Chulin 83, the Talmud makes it quite clear that this is Scripture's ruling.
That last part I don't understand. I looked up the Gemara in Chulin, and I'm not sure to what he was referring. Here is sort of Moshe Feinstein's argument. It's, you have, a rabbinic explanation. In a weird way, you've got, according to Pshat in the Gemara, right, there seemed to have been a rabbinic injunction based on a, that they saw something was wrong and they needed to institute something that wasn't there before. But according to Rav Moshe's interpretation in this paragraph, that it must have been biblical. It says, impossible to say that a rabbinic law would override a biblical dictum. Even though that might be apparent from Pshat in the Gemara, his assumption here is that it was as if the projecting balcony had been explicitly ordained and there was no need for it to be written down. Also, it says here, no need for God this year, nothing proper to transmit this matter except about the working plans. So, in a weird way, he's saying, well, it obviously must have been so apparent and clear that no one would have needed to have written it down, ignoring again all the other details, because also rabbis wouldn't have been able to override it. That seems to be his logic for saying that it is a biblical prohibition. Right? So I'll continue. Therefore, if a balcony was required to separate men from the women, that too must have been by biblical law. So it would also seem from a passage in the Jerusalem Talmud, Sukkah 5:5, commenting on the addition which amended to the temple structure, it states, "Whence did they learn that they should build it? From something in the Bible." Thus, the separation is referred to as a biblical matter. Right? Now, even though here, right, when the sages are extrapolating a verse, and sages do this repeatedly, they extrapolate verses, you know, well, can argue, I'll actually say, like, whether or not it explicitly contradicts something previously stated in the Bible, but his argument here is that the fact that they teach it out from a source in the Bible, you know, it's good enough. Now he says, even though its source in the Bible, Zechariah 12:12, is a verse from the prophets, the Divrei Kabbalah, as mentioned, in which case the rule is it cannot establish any biblical prohibition, here a biblical law can be derived from it, can well be derived from it. For the verse does not seek to originate any prohibition, but merely requires that mourning be observed in accordance with apparently pre-existing scriptural law, men separate and women separate. We learn similarly of many biblical laws from the actions of prophets, judges, and kings out of verses quoted in the oral tradition. Normally, these would come under the category of an asmachta. To give one example, and you know, the laws of mourning are a good example of this. Many of the practices of mourning are not mentioned explicitly in the Torah, but they are extrapolated from psukim of, well, you know, there's one source that from which the sages derive, well, here's a biblical source where you have to mourn. What are considered the laws of mourning? Well, here's a pasuk that tells us something about mourning. Here's a pasuk that tells us something about mourning. How do you know that mourning is Shiva, 7 days? Ah, we figure that out from Eov. And that you use it as an asmachta to fill in gaps. Here, I mean, you could argue you don't really have that as much, but we'll get to the critiques a little bit later. This, you know, focus at least on Rav Moshe's argument right now, that he's saying that since there might be a verse in the prophets, but rather it is all, it's not being used to say this as the originating source, but rather you are, it's only redefining something that is pre-existing somehow. Right, even right. So we take that for what it's worth. We'll again, we'll actually see a critique later. So from the Talmud's discussion in 51a, we learn something more. Even if there is a mechitza separator, but such as could permit, such could permit a state of levity to come about, the same biblical prohibition remains in force. For originally in the women's court of the temple on this Sukkot festival night, women were within and men outside. Rashi explains that actually the former were in the women's court proper while the men occupied the temple mount and the enclosure within the rant. There was a great mechitza between them as the law required, but because people had to stand near the open gate to see the proceedings, it was noticed that levity soon obtained, against which the mechitza availed nothing. It was this situation which biblical law forbade, and therefore it was decided to build a balcony. So the issue for Rav Moshe Feinstein here is particularly the intermingling leading to levity, leading to kalut rosh, such that it's not enough to have men and women separate. It's not enough to have a mechitza. What's important is to have an effective mechitza. What is an effective mechitza? That which prevents the intermingling that would lead to levity.
What was the things about rant?
Rant?
Rant part? Rant period?
Oh, to enclosure with the rampart.
Oh.
Yeah. OCR. I'm blaming. I mean, look, I ran spell check on this thing, but rant and part are two legitimate words. Sorry about that. I'll fix this when I post this online. So the rampart. Alright, nor did biblical prohibition apply because men and women might seclude themselves. We'll skip to the next paragraph. So it then becomes clear that a balcony was necessary by original biblical law so that women would be above and men below, and then they would in no sense mingle or communicate. As the Mishnah states, the wall of the women's court was smooth at first, then a balcony traversed its length so that women could see the festivities from above and the men from below, that they would not be intermingled. This proves that originally, even though they were separated by an adequate mechitza, they were considered as if commingling. Such a situation violated biblical law, which implicitly demanded then a balcony. The conclusion to be drawn is that in the synagogue as well, where men and women gather to pray, it is best to have a balcony so that women will be on the upper level. If for some reason it is too difficult to build a balcony, a physical separation in the full sense of the term must be installed, such as will rule out any possible frivolity. Therefore, a mechitza 10 handbreadths high, about 1 yard, is inadequate. Even though the reason why 10 tefachim high is normally that is considered a halachic mechitza, a halachic separation for boundaries, like for Eruvin. You know, the minimum height for a wall in any other thing for a shiur is 10 tefachim. Here he's saying that's inadequate, for it is worthless as a guard against levity. People can talk and continue to chatter at length without any hindrance, even when seated. This allows for the greatest possible state of levity. Therefore, in such a case, those present would be regarded as actual commingling, and a biblical prohibition would obtain, for this is worse than the mechitza, which separated the women's court from the rampart enclosure in the temple. The latter mechitza was far more substantial, yet its open gates rendered it ineffective. The mechitza must therefore be made to such a height as to effectively preclude any possible frivolous frivolous mood. He, Litvin adds, in a personal communication, the author of this responsum, one of the recognized poskim, final authorities in Jewish law of our generation, wrote further concerning his legal opinion, June 17, 1957. Dear Mr. Litvin, in reference to what is written in my name, that quote, the prohibition of mixed pews is biblical law, it would be better to change the words to read, the prohibition against praying in a synagogue without a mechitza of at least 18 tefachim handbreadths, or 65 inches high, is a biblical law. Stronger emphasis should be put on the point that it is prohibited to pray in a synagogue without a proper mechitza, even though there is separate seating. Okay? So I think this kind of illustrates Rav Moshe's position. Just very quick summarization based on his interpretation of Gemara in Sukkot. There is a biblical prohibition against intermingling of the sexes that may lead to frivolity, even in a religious setting, because if it happened in the Beis HaMikdash, it can happen in a synagogue, such that not only do you need separation of the sexes, you need a mechitza, and not just a normal mechitza of 10 tefachim, but one that is 65 inches high. Which is, someone wants to, you know, do the math here. Unfortunately, we don't have a yardstick here. Yeah. Only 12 feet.
It's just a little less than 6 feet.
Just a little less than 6 feet, yeah. That's a pretty high mechitza. 6 feet. You know, about, you know, 2 yards
well,
or so.
5.5 feet.
That's all right.
So, does he get the 18th fucking from somewhere?
Not... I would say yes. I mean, I don't know. I didn't check offhand where. I would guess it's based off of, you know, other sources in terms of what would make an adequate separation. You know, in terms of enough to hinder communication. So that's the opinion of Rav Moshe Feinstein. So for him, mixed seating, it violates a biblical prohibition. Right? Now here, there isn't as much of a polemic that you might say. It's just, you know, I mean, we saw, you know, certain things well mentioned conservative by name, but at least you see that he took this as a severe enough deviation from halachic Judaism to say this violates biblical prohibition, which is pretty significant. You find a little bit more, I mean, he did introduce it by saying, you know, there are localities in this country where people are breaking with the practice of having a mechitza. So there seems to be some concern for it, even though it's not necessarily conservative by name. He doesn't mention conservative in this teshuvah, because it seems to be, you know, a little bit more common than just that. All right?
This, I mean, part of my overall issue is sort of the degrees of separation, the degrees of exclusion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is he saying here that he would not let his daughter marry the son of someone who doesn't?
Yeah, you know. There are actually a bunch of other teshuvot that he cites in here that where Rav Moshe deals with it. I'm not sure. I'm not going to speak for Rav Moshe in terms of his sense of inclusion, but he is saying that when he says that, you know, synagogues as an institution are deviating from Jewish law in their very construction, it seems to me that that would, you know, be kind of you know, it attaches to it a significant gravitas that you otherwise, you know, might not find. It might not be as much as he said regarding conservative Jews directly. When we get right, we're going to do Rav Soloveitchik next. And Rav Soloveitchik will, in fact, make some very strong distinctions there in terms of an explicit exclusion of such synagogues.
A couple of thoughts of mine. There was a guy that was a disciple of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein who ridiculed the transparent pizza at Lincoln Square as wink and stare.
Yeah, that's common.
Yeah,
that I remember. And then there was also a congregation Amuna on 23rd Street during Rabbi Leifer's administration there, which had no mekitzah. Some people sat, there were three choices, sit on the right side, left side, right side, or the middle. In the middle, there was no mekitzah between. Mm-hmm. There was a balcony upstairs, nobody bothered with the, it was mixed seating. So, it's like, from what I've experienced, if you want to go with the guy who wants to be machmir, so you go with him. You want to lighten up, you go with this other guy.
You just used the important term "want to be machmir," want to be strict. Yeah. For Moshe Feinstein, it's not a stringency; it's a biblical prohibition to have any mechitza that does not effectively separate the men and the women. Right?
That's,
now, relative to other opinions, you might say, "Oh, he's taking a stricter approach." He does not see this as a chumrah. And it's important to make that distinction. Like, there's sometimes say, well, I can see it both ways, but tov lahachmir. Sometimes rabbis will make such statements, if not using those words, something similar. This isn't him being tov lahachmir. This is saying, in his opinion, it violates a d'oraisa.
Regardless of his opinion,
well,
I think he's being mahachmir.
Well, okay, because you're taking another approach. All right, fair enough. Well, actually, well, obviously, not everyone, well, we'll save that for the end. Next up is Rav Soloveitchik. Also, these things are printed in the sanctity of the synagogue. First is a message to a rabbinic convention. Take it.
I regret exceedingly in my inability to be at this most important conference of our organization. On strict orders of the doctor, I must not engage for the time being in public speaking or even attend public functions. Please accept my heartfelt wishes for very successful and fruitful deliberations and discussions which should, in turn, be translated into realities. I also wish to express to you my deep appreciation of and admiration for your unselfish and untiring efforts in behalf of Torah and traditional Judaism. I know how much you have given to the cause of strengthening the Orthodox rabbinate, to solidify its position, and to promote its objectives. May the Almighty bestow upon you His infinite blessings and grant you health and fortitude to carry on your good work for many more years. Yes, it's a difficult one, but the harder the mission, the greater is the reward.
Bafum Tara Agra. Yeah. All right, continue.
The Rabbinical Council of America stands now at the crossroads and must decide either to assume boldly and courageously the time-honored by ages sanctified role of the traditional rabbinate, which traces its history back to Joshua, Moses, and Sinai, and thus be ready to fight for undiluted halakha, which is often not in the vogue, or to deteriorate into a so-called modern rabbinic group of undefined quality and of a confused ideology, vague in its attitudes and undecided as to its policies.
All right, so now is where you can start getting into the more polemical type of language here, where he's clearly not thrilled with what, you know, certainly conservative Judaism, Monetary P, cites it directly, but he's making it the appeal that, you know, we're all packed to the original Masorah going all the way back to Har Sinai, fight for an undiluted halacha, don't water it down, right? And not deteriorate into undefined quality, confused ideology, vague in its attitudes and undecided as to its policies. Rav Soloveitchik could be very eloquent at times. And I just happen to love this, you know, statement here. And, you know, you could actually argue, based on the history of conservative Judaism, whether or not it fell into these things, certainly about undefined equality and confused ideology, given that in its own history, how often it had to wrestle with, what is conservative Judaism? And it does that far too often. Dan, could you hear the next paragraph in particular?
In particular, I wish to call the attention of the conference to the Mechitza problem. I continually receive reports from laymen from all parts of the country accusing many rabbis of displaying indecisiveness and even cowardice in this matter. They charge them with laxity and indifference, even in cases when the traditionally minded individuals are willing to organize in defense of the principle of segregation. I have the feeling that a well-coordinated aggressive effort on our part may stop, if not reverse even, the trend of Christianization of the synagogue. However, many of our colleagues choose the Derech Kitzarava Arucha,
the easy way which leads to doom. Meaning, you take a shortcut that's really longer. The Christianization line he explains in a later letter. I know you're probably thinking about that, but that's in a later letter. So, can you...
I do hereby reiterate the statement I have made on numerous occasions, both in writing and orally, that a synagogue with a mixed seating arrangement forfeits its sanctity and its halachic status of mikdash ma'at, a sanctuary in miniature, and is unfit for prayer and avodah shebelev, the service of the heart.
Now this is pretty explicit here. Mixed seating arrangement forfeits its sanctity and its halachic status of mikdash ma'at, unfit for prayer and avodah shebelev.
With full cognizance of the implications of such a halakhic decision, I would still advise every Orthodox Jew to forego tefillah b'tzibur, group prayer, even on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, rather than enter a synagogue with mixed pews, notwithstanding the fact that the officiating rabbi happens to be a graduate of a great and venerable yeshiva. No rabbi, however great in scholarship and moral integrity, has the authority to endorse, legalize, or even apologetically explain this basic deviation. Any rabbi or scholar who attempts to sanction the desecrated synagogue, ipso facto, casts a doubt on his own moral right to function as a teacher or a spiritual leader in the traditional sense of the word. No pretext, excuse, ad hoc formula, missionary complex, or unfounded fear of losing our foothold in the Jewish community can justify the acceptance of Christianized synagogues as a bona fide Jewish religious institution.
Yeah. I'll continue. I mean, that's really the point, but here's one last paragraph of great bit of polemic.
But this is also an example of what you said. No matter how great you thought he was, if he says something that disagrees with me...
Well, we'll get that in the response there. I'll finish the last piece.
The greater the difficulty, the more biting the ridicule and sarcasm, and the more numerous the opponent, then the holier is the principle, and the more sacred is our duty to defend it. In my opinion, the halach victim... Bishat Kizerat Hamalchut, Afilu Mitzvah Kala Kigon, Lishinui Arkata, Lishinuye Arkata, De Misana, Yehareg Va'al Yavor. At a time of religious persecution through government decree, even for a minor custom, such as one involving changing a shoelace, let one suffer death sooner than transgress it.
Right.
Sanhedrin 74b.
Right.
Requiring of us a heroic stand in times of adversity applies not only to political and religious persecution originated by some pagan ruler, but also to situations in which a small number of God-fearing and Torah-loyal people is confronted with a hostile attitude on the part of the majority dominated by a false philosophy.
Yeah. In the next letter, we'll explain, like, exactly, you know, what is, you know, Rosolovich's position, you know. You know, this statement here is more of a polemic, which is understandable. It was written towards the Rabbinical Council of it might not be the Rabbinical Council of America. No, it is. Yeah, it says here, Rabbinical Council of America. It actually says in a letter. So he's writing to the
Orthodox.
Yeah. Writing to the Orthodox, but he's also saying, you know, charging them, this is I mean, certainly in no uncertain terms, mechitzas are bad. Not, no mechitza synagogues are bad, to the point where excluded, to the point of Christianized, right? Using that term, which you'll explain later, point where you shouldn't, it's no longer a synagogue, no longer has Kedusha, shouldn't daven there even on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Better to not go, even if the rabbi happens to be observant. In which case, unlike, you know, the problem with, unlike what we saw with Rav Moshe Feinstein, in terms of accepting a conservative pulpit, it was the mere affiliation of, you know, being conservative that invalidated you. Here, it's something else. Here, there's actually something more concrete of a perceived violation of halakha that's enough to exclude you from Judaism. Meaning, you could argue whether or not it was political or not, but it's more than just you can't be a rabbi of a conservative shul, it's you can't be a rabbi of a non-mechitza synagogue. The difference being, even if there was an Orthodox affiliated synagogue without a mechitza, you know, all of this would still technically apply.
The thing that turns me off... Let one suffer death sooner than transgress it. Who is he to tell
well,
me that I have to go get killed?
Right. So something? That's a Gemara about, in a time, we mentioned about the Harig Zal Yampur, the time you're supposed to allow yourself to be killed rather than do something. So there are usually three things. There's another Zera here is that, well, actually, if there's a time of certain government religious persecution, and there's so much, in every action has so much more meaning, the fact that he invokes the Harig Zal Yampur in this case here, I don't think he would mean that you ought to allow yourself to be killed rather than daven in a non-mechitza pulpit. I don't think he would take that step. But he's trying to elicit that type of emotional urgency that you would have.
That's where he loses.
That's why. It's a polemics are like this, but also he's speaking to the Rabbinical Council of America, you know, where it's, you know, he's trying to charge them with Rav Soloveitchik, widely venerated, you know, gets very emotional and very passionate about a certain issue, is conveying this ostensibly so that other rabbis would feel as passionate about such an issue, such as not to give in. Now, not having lived in, you know, the late 50s when this was written, I don't know what the culture was. I don't know what the tensions were. Mm-hmm. We'll explain, you know, possibly a little bit later. It's possible he had, whether or not he actually believed in the logic and the argument of everything else that he said, he could have believed that this was an issue that was important enough that required such language. It's very well possible. We'll talk about that a little afterwards. Next is also from the book, a passage called On Seeming and Sanctification. This is the question which has been raised. Lately, there has been a great increase in the number of synagogues where men and women sit together. Many of them are attended by Jews who designate themselves as Orthodox. See? There you go. Shall Orthodox Judaism then consider such synagogues as an inevitable development and become reconciled to them, or must assume a militant stand against them? To make absolutely clear my position on this leading question, I would like to relate this incident. A young man moved into a suburb of Boston where the only extant synagogue had men and women sitting together. He asked me what he should do on the high holidays, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Until then, on account of the mixed seating, he had not entered the synagogue, but on the days of awe, he was very reluctant to remain at home. I answered him that it were better for him to pray at home on both Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and not cross the threshold of that synagogue. A few days later, he telephoned me again. He had met a man who was to sound the shofar in that synagogue, and this man had warned him that if he did not come to the synagogue, he would simply not hear the shofar at all, for the man would not sound the shofar again privately for his benefit. The young man practically implored me that I grant him permission to enter the edifice, at least for half an hour, that he might hear the shofar blasts. I hesitated not for a moment, but directed him to remain at home. It would be better not to hear the shofar than to enter a synagogue whose sanctity has been profaned. Now keep in mind, hearing the shofar is explicitly a biblical positive biblical commandment. No drashot on that, it's there. Right? By corner of Soloveitchik, better not hear the shofar at all and fulfill a biblical obligation than enter a synagogue with mixed seating. My stringent position regarding the mingling of men and women arises from several reasons. First of all, such mingling is forbidden according to the halakha. In certain instances, biblical law prohibits praying in a synagogue where men and women are seated together. Such locale has none of the sanctity of a synagogue, and prayers offered there are worthless in the eyes of Jewish law. Secondly, the separation of the sexes in the synagogue derives historically from the sanctuary, where both in which would be a court of women and a court of Israelites. It is in its martyr's history of 1,000 years, the people of Israel have never violated the sacred principle. Moreover, when primitive Christianity arose as a sect in the Holy Land and began to slowly introduce reforms, one of the innovations which the sect established at once in the externals of synagogue practice was to have men and women sit together. In many instances, mixed seating was the unmistakable sign by which a Jew could recognize he had found not a place of sanctity for Jews to pray, but rather the prayer house for a deviating sect. For in those times, the Christians had not yet formally differentiated themselves from traditional Jewry. A secret sect, they endeavored to hide their identity, and only through certain definite signs could they be recognized. So to take these two parts here, you have one, it's forbidden according to biblical law. The intermingling seems to be similar to what Rav Moshe Feinstein said, right? But then he takes it a step further and says, any place loses the sanctity of synagogue and the prayers there are worthless. According to this then, we'll do this one at a time. I'm trying to remember. What do you want to do? You can finish all of these and then discuss, or...
I'd rather do it one at a time.
One at a time. Okay. So let's take this first piece here, right? Mingling, that part we saw. But the fact that when such a locale doesn't have the sanctity of a synagogue, and prayers are offered, they're worthless in the eyes of Jewish law, right? You know, that's somewhat of a statement which here at least doesn't really seem to be substantiated. The main thing here is, you know, he doesn't really elaborate, at least in this source. I think he may in a later one. The second one here is the historical argument, which you could argue as well, Jews have never done this. Not only did Jews never have done this, but who instituted mixed eating? Christians, which is where you had that Christianized... line in the previous one. I don't know if this is actually historically true. I don't know how you go about proving it, but from Rav Soloveitchik's perspective, the fact that the Christians started it and the Jews have never done it shows at least there's some social component to it, or at least that's more than just social, but rather an attitude towards religion. We'll skip to, and it would seem to me here that our remembrance of history alone should keep us from imitating today the practice of primitive Christianity almost 1900 years ago. Now, keep in mind here, the first one is a matter of, the intermingling violates biblical law, right? Now that, you might say, well, to violate one law, you can't violate one law to fulfill another law. It would be mitzvah haba ba'aveira, in which case you don't actually fulfill your obligation. So remember, according to Rav Soloveitchik, better you not hear the shofar than hear it in a mixed seating shul. Right? If you want to talk about an actual prohibition, like that could lead you, to get such a conclusion of why would you nullify a biblical commandment, right? The first one, if you assume the premise that it is a biblical prohibition of mixed seating, okay, right? That might make, some halachic sense. If you're going to base it off of, well, the historical, the remembrance of history alone, yeah, that should keep you from, doing what someone else did to the extent that you wouldn't fulfill a mitzvah d'oraisa.
Yeah.
Maybe not. Thirdly, the entire concept of family pews is in contradiction to the Jewish spirit of prayer. Prayer means communication with master of the world, and therefore withdrawal from all and everything. During prayer, man must feel alone, removed, and isolated. He must then regard all the Creator on... regard the Creator as an old one friend from whom he can hope for support and consolation. So there's another thing here that it fits. I mean, it might seem as a non-halachic sequitur, but it fits in nicely with a lot of his other approaches to religion. For example, see Lonely Man of Faith for just one example there. It's an I don't want to get into the discussion about his philosophy of prayer because, you know, that would take us too far off topic. Only to throw in here that if, you know, one question that I think you might ask that if during prayer men must feel alone, removed, and isolated, why do you have tefillah b'tzibur?
Yeah.
You know, it's an obvious question. I'm sure, you know, Rav Soloveitchik deals with it. I'm not an expert in his thought. By expert, I mean one problem with dealing with the ins and outs of Rav Soloveitchik is that because he is so prominent, many of his students really fight over how to interpret him. Even amongst Yeshiva University, people portray Rav Soloveitchik in a whole lot of different ways. Example would be there was a Rosh Yeshiva at his funeral who said that he never saw Rav Soloveitchik reading a secular book, which would have been factually true, but it's to give an impression of Rav Soloveitchik that was clearly false. You don't do a PhD in, you know, University of Berlin in philosophy without reading secular books. You don't cite Rudolf Otto at the beginning of one of your books and say, obviously, you know, he never read it. That's one reason why I'm intentionally being a little bit evasive regarding the thought of Rav Soloveitchik, because it's too complicated to handle in a class like this that won't involve, you know, just really unproductive discussions about what Rav Soloveitchik really meant. So I'm just going to focus on what he actually said, and limit the speculation a bit. Right, and it says, clearly the presence of women among men, or of men among women, which often evokes a certain frivolity in the group, either in spirit or behavior, can contribute to little sanctification or deepening of religious feeling, nor can it help instill that mood in which a man must immerse when he would communicate with the Almighty. And we could probably, you know, skip the rest here in terms of the phlegmas, because we kind of saw that already in a different form. All right? So here, right, from the purposes of exclusion, it doesn't really get much bigger than saying you can't enter that shul even to hear shofar. That's a pretty big statement to make. You may argue, from combining that with the Eharig al Yavor line, that he saw this as a halachic issue that was so important in terms of defining Judaism as a whole in America, to that extent, which I don't think is unrealistic. I will also let's finish off with the open letter. We'll discuss a little bit more with Soloveitchik Slug before we get to a rebuttal. So Ed, start us off. This is a final piece with him called an open letter.
First, let me reiterate in precise and unequivocal terms my position with regard to the seating arrangement in a house of worship. The separation of the sexes in the synagogue is a basic tenet in our faith. It dates back to the very dawn of our religious halakhic community and constitutes a Pentateuchic injunction, Isser Deoraisa, which can never be abandoned by any legislative act on the part of a rabbinic or lay body, regardless of its numeric strength or social prominence. What was decreed by God can never be undone by human hand. My opinion, mingling of the sexes. Mingling of the sexes is by far a more flagrant violation of a great principle than installing an organ or praying with bare heads. Unfortunately, while every traditionally minded Jew understands that the latter practices tend to strip our synagogue of its Judaic quality and are tantamount to an attempt to Christianize our ritual, many well-meaning and sincere Jews, I guess it's a mess, are being misled with respect to the mixed seating arrangement.
Wow. I have to say, this OCR is not really impressive.
Yeah, which one?
Nuance.
It came with it.
Yeah. Yes. And let me take on from here, because we're running a little bit late. I wish to state that I do not know of any Orthodox rabbi or Talmudic scholar of high repute who would dare say that mixed seating is in consonance with our law. Neither the Orthodox rabbinate of America, consisting of three major organizations, nor the chief rabbi of Great Britain and its dominions, nor the rabbinate of the Holy Land would ever vaguely suggests that such a practice is permissible. The requirement for separation is halachically so elementary and axiomatic, historically so typical of the synagogue in contradistinction to the church since antiquity, and philosophically so expressive to our religious experience, that whoever dares question this institution is either uninformed or consciously distorts religious realities. As to whether or not the halacha also requires segregation, I wish to say there is certainly a requirement for the erection of a partition, and the synagogue which fails to erect one is guilty of violating a very sacred tradition. However, there is a basic difference between this wrong and that of complete mingling of the sexes, for as I indicated above, separation has its origin in the Bible itself, with the requirement of mechitza must be attributed to rabbinic ordinance. And then he cites the Gemara from Sukkah 51b. All right, hammering it home here in as clear, unequivocal terms as possible. Now, when, you know, the point is here, this is, you know, certainly grounds for exclusion, you know, for Rav Soloveitchik. Question, before we get to the rebuttal, is why? I'm going to speculate here that at the time, in, you know, late 50s, right, we mentioned that there was a clear competition between Orthodox and Conservative. You had certain ideological differences that the Orthodox felt if these conservative ideologies took hold, there would be severe long-term ramifications in Judaism. And which is one of the reasons why I liked his line of the, what was it, undefined quality, confused ideology, vague in its attitudes as to its policies. That's kind of a real concern you have. If you're going to try to push envelopes or to try to make changes and you don't really know what you're doing, you don't really have set ground rules, that is a very dangerous proposition. And at this stage in conservative Judaism in the late 50s, that I think was a real problem. In the proceedings of the Rabbinical Assembly, I believe from 48, I believe it was Rabbi Louis Epstein that, you know, complained that the Committee of Jewish Law and Standards gave them the power to permit everything and prohibit nothing. And he proposed that, you know, the actual rabbinic law, the Committee of Jewish Laws and Standards would follow the Shulchan Aruch, be it stringent or lenient, and that got voted down. Right, because we discussed when conservative Judaism kind of arose, there wasn't a clear ideology. So if you're just going to make certain changes, well, what's the criteria for what changes you can make and what you can't? That, I think, is a problem that has been with conservative Judaism for many years. And Rav Soloveitchik, I think, saw that in its inception, or at least when certain things happened, where even if you could argue one way or the other, you know, and work it in, it would be too much of a change. Now, why would this be an issue? For his time, synagogue attendance was, I believe, one of the core identifiers of your religion and your religious affiliation. Ironically, it's kind of a Protestant, you know, type of mentality of whether or not you're Jewish is whether or not you show up to shul, right? If you look in the grand scheme of halacha, you know, davening with a minyan as a requirement, you know, isn't really as incumbent on people. But the psychology for, you know, your typical religious practitioner was you have to go to synagogue. And it's sort of like a carryover in, you know, most of the Jewish population surveys. It's how often, you know, do you go? There are a lot of questions on synagogue attendance, which itself assumes synagogue attendance is a, you know, major thing. Whether or not that takes a role in Judaism as a, you know, major, you know, pillar, if that's your only exposure to Judaism, then it's your exposure that's that important. So if you don't have much of a religious life outside of synagogue, then certainly any deviation from the synagogue is a deviation in your entire sense of Judaism. That's pretty severe. I will also add that if Rav Soloveitchik did not use these languages, he would have been ignored. How so? I might have said this in a previous lecture. I apologize if I repeat myself. On the case of women's tefillah groups, Rav Soloveitchik was clearly not a fan. Yet when Eda, the organization, first came out, there were people saying that we are for women's prayer groups and we are following the tradition of Rav Soloveitchik. To that, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Rav Soloveitchik's son-in-law, wrote one of the clearest things I've ever seen him read write in English, because usually he's very academic and can be a very dense writer, and here he was just very atypically clear. It was wonderful, where he basically said, look, you want to argue about women's tefillah groups, that's one discussion, but to say you're doing it in Rav Soloveitchik's name is dishonest. I don't know if he used the word dishonest. At the very least, it would be misleading. The argument was, well, Rav Soloveitchik might not have liked it, but he never said it was asur. He never said it was prohibited. Unless you use the term asur, prohibition, people aren't going to take you seriously. Right? People will say, oh, well, he didn't say it's asur, therefore it must mean it's mutar, and therefore we can do it. Which in one halachic sense, fine. But if you're looking at things from a big picture perspective of what are the ramifications, especially if you are in such a position where your statements can affect your entire country's religious observance, you have to be pretty careful that way. And yes, you might make a one halachically nuanced position, or might, yeah, that's good for the for certain rabbis, but if other people are going to ignore you, you've just lost, a very great battle. So women's tefillah groups wasn't going to be as a dividing line as mechitza, turned out to be. So, I think that's very important to keep in mind as to, is this a, polemic of exclusion? Absolutely. Was it necessary? Quite possibly. Certainly Rav Soloveitchik thought it was. And again, whether or not history has borne that out, who knows what might have happened if relationships might have been different between conservative and orthodox. The way things went, you can say, well, sure. However, he did have that line about no one could offer any sort of justification. So for this, even though it's, somewhat out of, the realm of exclusion, and normally we haven't done rebuttals because the focus has always been on what are the issues that are causing people to be excluded? Why are these issues exclusion? What's the rhetoric of how that works? But this was written by my dad. This is an artist whose, I should add, is celebrating a birthday today, August 21st. So happy birthday. He's listening. He's actually in Israel right now visiting my sister, brother-in-law, and the kids there. So this was an article written in 1979 called Mechitza, Midrash, and Modernity, A Study in Religious Discourse. I'm taking a few things out of context. It's a lot of, I would say longish article, but worthwhile reading and getting all the footnotes. So one piece here is when he's discussing with the passage from Rav Soloveitchik. Says this passage's context refers to the requirement that ancient Israelites preserve a state of ritual purity in their camp so as to ensure God's protective presence. Not only is the context not related to separation or segregation of sexes, none of the medieval enumerations of the 613 commandments consider this verse to be the source for an eternally binding law. According to Maimonides, a verse must be cited by the Talmudic authorities on the basis of an exegetical tradition of the oral law. I'm sorry, the verse that he's referring to is Lotiyebecha Ervat Davar. We may have glossed over that in one of the passages in there. Or be derived by any means of classical rules of exegesis, and it must be a commandment given to Israel, which is binding for all time. By employing the rhetoric of Midrash Halacha, Rabbi Soloveitchik implies that he possesses both the authority and tradition to define the meaning and application of the Pentateuch, prerogative traditionally reserved for the members of the Great Sanhedrin. Equally far-reaching is Rav Soloveitchik's attribution of the requirement that the sexes be segregated by means of a partition to a rabbinic injunction. Rabbinic law must be legislated and recorded. If a prohibition is not specifically mentioned and promulgated as such by the Talmud or the codes, the restriction is at best a minhag or local ordinance of regional validity. Rabbi Soloveitchik tacitly admits the weakness of his position by attributing the requirement of that the sexes be segregated to a rabbinic ordinance, the source of which is not cited, but rather it's only implied from the Gemara in the Gemara that we saw from Sukkah. On dealing with Feinstein, by defining family pews as a violation of Pentateuchal law, Rabbi Feinstein denies the sanctity even of traditional conservative congregations because they cease to conform to the mandates which has been defined by Pentateuchal law. Similarly, rabbis who grace such pulpits are heretics because they deny the religious authority of the Pentateuch as understood by Rabbi Feinstein. Consequently, one ought not to respond amen to a benediction recited by a non-Orthodox rabbi, while the benediction of a non-observant doctor ought to be answered. The former, by rejecting an authoritative sage, is a heretic. The latter, moved by impulses presumably other than ideology, is not. Further, Rabbi Feinstein begrudgingly tolerates the institution of a bar mitzvah with all of its abuses, only because it was instituted by Orthodoxy. The bat mitzvah rite is opposed for no other reason other than it was instituted by non-Orthodox leaders. So my father, writing in 1979, just asked the very silly question that if, you know, the mingling of the sexes, you know, either by a separation or the requirement of mechitza, is such a fundamental part of Jewish law, how come no one said it beforehand? Meaning, God's normally not shy in terms of saying, do this, don't do that, yet he never said you had to daven separately. Chazal never said tefillah had to be separate. Now, you could argue, well, you know, maybe women didn't daven at that time, or maybe they didn't have women coming to shul such that they never could have. But my father's argument is this. If you're going to say anything in the realm of halakha, it has to be done through an act of explicit legislation, not through implication. If you want to do it through implication, it can certainly be a plausible argument, in that, yeah, you might be able to infer things from certain gemara. But to say that it's a biblical injunction, you need to come with much better sources than just your own derasha from, you know, a pasuk in Navi. And, you know, to say that, you know, as Rav Moshe Feinstein put it well, you know, it's obviously it must have been done there before because of his assumptions on how Jewish law would work, even though there's no explicit verse saying you have to do this for this reason. Not so convincing for my father. To base it on lo tia becha ervat davar, to the point where it would supersede the biblical requirement to hear shofar, not as convincing for certain people back then. So, you know, at the time, there were people that would argue on halachic grounds, which is basically, if this is a d'oraisa, you should be able to prove it. Right, or at least a lot more conclusively than saying, well, it's so obvious it didn't need to be stated. Right, so that's why I threw that in here. We'll spend a few more weeks talking about, you know, other issues where gender becomes that dividing line, and perhaps thinking about why these gender issues may be, might be so important. One possibility is that it's not even so much the gender side as much as any change to the synagogue service, which because of social evolution took on a really prominent role in Jewish life, not unlike, you know, issues you might have had about praying in English, right, being a deviation of the temple service. And it could be that, you know, at certain stages, certain changes might have been more acceptable than others when you weren't as threatened by the consequences. But we'll see how that plays out in a couple of other cases. Have a wonderful day. Yeah, throwing in a little addendum here based on some of the questions that were discussed about, can you have one law superseding another? I mentioned earlier you have mitzvah habab aveira, right? Where if the only way you could do a mitzvah is by violating some other law, you know, one example being lulav hagazul. The only way that you could shake lulav and etrog is by stealing it. You're not allowed to steal. There are certain times when the rabbis will have a law that will supersede a biblical commandment in terms of the Sheva Altasa. One thing would be Megillah reading on Shabbos. I mean, if Purim would fall out on Shabbos reading the Megillah, or blowing shofar on Shabbos, right? Even though, like, they had Erevin at the time, right, there was still enough of a concern, someone was going to carry a shofar such that they made a takana, better not hear the shofar at all. Right? So, you know, you could argue there too in terms of, you know, the nature of rabbinic authority. Well, they didn't actually supersede it, you know, but they're telling you don't do a biblical commandment. You know, other people may find, you know, some more nuanced approaches there in terms of, well, when do they enter, when do they not? The case I just mentioned is a Sheva al Ta'aseh, in which case, you know, the rabbis aren't telling you to explicitly violate biblical law. They would say, well, just don't do one. Meaning a Sheva al Ta'aseh of sit and don't do anything is considered to be less of an offense than proactively violating something. Makes sense in terms of the distinction there about the biblical rabbinic law things. So with here, you know, Rav Soloveitchik, you know, said, you know, better not enter into a shul. If you believe that it is a mitzvah, it's an iser to oraisa, right, such that you're violating a biblical prohibition. Now, keep in mind, like, if the biblical like, in terms of what the biblical prohibition there, if it's the mingling, right, and this also, I think, might require some elaboration there. In theory, you could go to a separate seating, to a mixed seating synagogue, stand in the back of the shul, right, like, off in a corner, and just listen to it and not mingle with anyone. Right, the psul that he has here seems to be of, like, you know, Evan Firm of entering, and you've come to think of it as, you know, talking about this now, it might very well be, you know, the analogy to Christianity might very well be, you know, taking this as, you know, almost like a makom of a dazara, that it's forbidden to even enter the sanctuary. Forget about praying, right? Because, you know, let's say you pray, you know, incorrect, like, in terms of violating a prohibition, if the real one is really the intermingling of the sexes, well, just don't necessarily intermingle, right? Or, you know, send off to the side. Whether or not he would say, you know, in the case that he mentioned, you know, I'm not sure if he would say the same thing if there was separate seating without a mechitza. If that would also be sufficient enough, you know, if separate seating without a mechitza would still be bad enough that you wouldn't hear a shofar. Yep. Don't know. I leave that up to students of his to argue. But it seemed that even just entering the room itself was a violation. You know, unless, you know, you also say none of the eight laws, so that he was in, you know, or not given the analogy to that Xeron V.A. Harig Val Yavor, you know, that it could have, you know, also seen that, you know what, even if this is just a Hora'at Sha'ah, which could be, you know, a way of an interpreting Rav Soloveitchik too, that the times were such that he thought this was a big enough threat to the future of Judaism in America that such extreme positions were completely warranted. Right? So when you talk about, you know, rabbis superseding law, you know, we saw earlier, it's like, you know, from Rav Moshe, it's like, oh, rabbis can't just come up with their own things against biblical law. And yet Rav Soloveitchik, you know, apparently did, in terms of telling someone don't hear shofar in Rosh Hashanah. When that happens and when that doesn't is a much bigger conversation that's not going to be for this class at all, that really gets to, you know, the source of the halachic process. What I would make a distinction, though, is that there is, I think, a legitimate distinction between halacha and psak. Meaning just because something may be technically permitted doesn't mean it's a good idea to do it. It's a distinction that I, you know, make repeatedly here in this shul, where even though, like, women's aliyot, right, even if I could give a really great reason, I think I have, of, like, why a woman could halachically get an aliyah, it's explicitly we're not doing here, and as long as I'm the rabbi, it's not going to happen. Right? But there is that distinction made, and I explain, you know, in greater detail why. You know, and that, you know, could be with what Rav Soloveitchik is doing. What I think really, you know, annoyed people like my father is when you say something is asur and you use that legal term, there are implications there of, like, either biblical or rabbinic that need to be justified, and you can't throw those terms out lightly. So those would be, like, some of the main reasons of, you know, my father's objections of, if it, you know, you want to say it's us or Doraisa, you know, show me a pasuk that actually backs up your statement. Or show me a place in Chazal where they explicitly say men and women are not allowed to daven together. Because the case of Simchat Beit HaShoeva, you know, there's one instance of, you know, levity, but they, because it's more of a simcha there, not an actual, you know, form of, you know, men and women praying together. There are also some, again, as I introduced here, Lichtman cites here a bunch of sources that talk about segregation of sexes, you know, in various rabbinic sources, you know, that could have some, you know, underlying thing there. And maybe you could say from the end of, you know, the Gemara and Sukkah, that there was some ethic or ethos that we needed to separate the sexes. But just because there might have been some, you know, ethic behind it is not the same as saying there's a biblical or rabbinic law, unless you can actually cite chapter and verse that says here's exactly what it means. Otherwise, you have a plausible interpretation for policy purposes, meaning to say, like, here's why we're not going to mingle based on this Gemara, and saying that there's actual biblical injunction against something. All right? So with that, we will conclude. Have a wonderful week.